This is GenClash, Queer Perspectives on Current Affairs, a Gay 45 European original podcast endorsed by the Vienna Business Agency, the organisation that provides support for founders and companies that grow or settle in Vienna.
Hello from London and Vienna, and welcome to GenClash, Queer Perspectives on Current Affairs. I am Maruna Tabariu, and I'm here with Rosvani On.
Hello, hello.
This week, we have on the table: European elections take place in less than a month and seem the tensest in the last decades. Pro-Palestine student protest in the US and Europe. How involved are queer organizations? What's at stake for LGBT plus rights in 2024 in Europe? Pet Shop Boys interviewed by Financial Times, Omar Sy by Le Parisien, and Salman Rushdie by The Guardian and Jon Stewart. And in the end, we recommend the best cinema and TV to watch these days. Every 5 years, like clockwork, mainstream politicians freak out about the rise of radicals and populists ahead of the European elections. But then, the danger suddenly seems to dissipate as the traditional centre-left and centre-right forces that built the European Union forge coalitions that hold more radical parties at bay. This time, it seems to not be the case. In 2024, the right-wing surge in the polls seems bigger and bolder, with more predicting that the nationalist right and far-right could pick up nearly a quarter of seats in the European Parliament in June. There's been an increase in right-wing voters in the LGBT plus community and more second-generation immigrants voting right-wing. The question is, with less than a month to the European elections, where do we stand?
It's not quite surprising what's happening right now. We see this in the last 4 years since Ursula von der Leyen took the presidency of the European Union and the European Parliament, actually. She's the chief commissary, as official name is. A lot of people consider her president of European Union, but to be clear for people who doesn't know how it's working, we will vote in a couple of weeks the European Union Parliament, and then the European Parliament will vote the president of European Commission, which is correspondent to national government. It's clear Politico, The Guardian, the most important media outlets, they show the right wing this time will have more than a quarter of the parliament, which is unprecedented. And regarding the president, I think you have more information about that. I don't recall exactly how the state for the elections of the president of the European Commission.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of counter candidates, even though I do think that von der Leyen stands a very big chance of just getting re-elected. There is, for example, Mario Draghi, who's the former Italian prime minister. Also Roberta Metsola, who is the president of the European Parliament. Christine Legrand. There's also the Romanian president, Klaus Iohannis, as well as Andrej Plenković, who is the prime minister of Croatia. But I think, not to derail the conversation a bit, but I think when thinking about the European elections, what worries me the most is, I mean, in the first place, what seats go to who, but more than that, the kind of what coalitions emerge at the top and what kind of allyships form between parties. Because I think that in some ways that they have more power in that sense, rather than, I think we should be thinking about what allies they have rather than looking at each party in isolation, if that makes sense.
There is not really isolated parties, because European Parliament function a little bit different from a national parliament. They need powerful groups. And I will not get through all the groups, but usually since many years, the popular group, which is including the Christian Democrats of von der Leyen, are the biggest group. To be clear, that contains some of the liberals and conservative parties. Then there is a socialist group, the second powerful group, and then it's the president of France formed the new group. Macron made a new group in the European Parliament since he was a president. But what I want to underline, it's ECR faction, which is including the post-fascist party Brothers of Italy. Brothers of Italy, it's the government party now in Italy, and it's run by the Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, and brought together the former Polish governing party, which has the sitting president, PiS, with a very terrifying president, Jaroslaw Kaczynski, the Swedish Democrats with Jimmy Åkesson, and the Hungarians. It's among other things, are the re-election of them, it will be a very complicated, and now it seems like they will be winning more percentage. And together, as you mentioned, in an alliance, I think they will have more than 25%, which is unprecedented. And
then the question arises, why worry about this? What will realistically change for us? But I think that a number of things will change for us, maybe very slowly. I definitely don't think it will be like we won't feel the effects immediately. But I think, especially in terms of most aspects of life, in terms of migration, LGBT rights, environmental policies, support for Ukraine from the EU, and lots of arms-related things and security-related things. So I think, I don't know, I'm quite scared because this feels like a very wide-reaching, it has wide-reaching consequences.
First of all, seems like a quarter of the parliament is not enough to change things, but it's not true because some of the votes needs a different type of vote. So 25%, it's a lot for the far right, and that show us the way of the politics favorites in different countries, which we didn't suspect until now, they will become so radical. Also, 25% means some of things can be pushed or stopped at a certain moment. That will be a complicated situation. But for the moment, we have to see how the party projections are and the final election result, which I hope to be at least not to be more than 25% for the far right.
And we'd also really love to stress that it's very important to vote and urge you all to get informed about who you can vote for, where you can vote for, if you're a European citizen, in the elections which will be held from the 6th to the 9th of June of this year. In the last few weeks, tens of thousands of students from around the world have come together to demand ceasefire in Palestine in an effort to draw attention to human rights violations in recent times. Students from the top world universities, among them Harvard, the Sorbonne, Amsterdam and Cambridge, have set up encampments in their campuses, organizing daily protests, disseminating information, and fighting to draw the attention of their fellow students, academic institutions, and the world that watches them from afar.
It's a very complicated moment in the world, not only with the war in Gaza, but the war in Ukraine, with Iran, which is threatening to bomb our countries, United States, who thinks they are the over the world police. So it's a crazy, crazy time. That reminds me of the Vietnam moment when the students protested vehemently against the war, against then later on when the students, I wasn't born there, but I was born when we protested against Afghanistan war, Iraq war, and at the end, I can say that at that moment I was a student, I can say for sure we have been right. I mean, nothing happened in Vietnam. It was a terrible war. Just people died. In Afghanistan, after 20 years, they left and Taliban came back. So no democracy, nothing. Iraq completely destroyed. So basically, the war never brought anything good. But made people rich.
So for context, I go to Cambridge University. One of the biggest encampments, the student encampments in the UK, is currently in Cambridge, very close to where I live. And I've been vaguely involved with some things.
And it's the number one university in the world right now this year.
All eyes are on us, honestly. There are people from the Daily Mail constantly taking photos of the encampment. So I've been...
Not my favorites, but anyway.
Yeah. Hopefully The Guardian will come as well.
The Guardian was writing extensively about Cambridge and about what's happening with the students, yeah.
But yeah, I think the general consensus is that I'm really glad you mentioned these past eras where students went up in arms collectively and around the world and protested for causes they really believed in. Because I think there's, at least with us, it generally feels like we are walking in the footsteps of those before us who protested against Vietnam, who protested during the AIDS epidemic, who protested for any other student protest, mass student protest that has happened in the last 50 years. And whilst there are different causes that people have protested for, I think students are in some ways very good at banding together and at fighting for things. And I have nothing but respect for the students at Cambridge who are camping out in front of King's College that I see every day. Some of them have their final exams, you know, some of them, it's very hard to think about going into a career or doing well academically. It feels very trivial when there are things going on in the world, the injustices going on in the world that you just can't look away from anymore.
But you have to remember the fact you are the future of this world. So you have a duty to fight for a better world. So what you do, it's important. What we did, it's important. We got old, we got tired maybe. We still go in the street, but not as we did before. But it's fair enough to do that. But every time when something is unjust, otherwise the governments will feel like they are right to do whatever they please. I'm happy to see, for example, my ex-university, Universiteit van Amsterdam, University of Amsterdam, having the same tradition like 20, 30 years ago. We did every time the students there did something. And of course, this time they were arrested again. And I know how it is. We've been, I was arrested 3 times. So it's a kind of a thing for the students.
I wanted to ask you about this. You have an activist past when you were a student and you fought for queer rights in Romania afterwards as well. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about it. I'm very interested to hear your experience.
It's not such so many things to say. I mean, it's just the past. Most of the protests I participated in was politics, and I still consider the HIV/AIDS protests we've been in, Silence is Death, you remember that. We did that with ACT UP just because it was also politic. Because we followed the medication from us, and our friends were dying, our lovers were dying around us just because they didn't want to release the medicine. It was a terrible time, and in Romania it was just happened. My mother being Romanian, I wanted to do something for the people who were arrested there. Most of the East Europe, they dismissed the laws against homosexuality, and they stopped arresting people. But in Romania, still happened until 92, 93, 94. So I just help a little bit. But the real heroes are in these countries, the people living there. Because for me, it was easy to go there when I have somewhere to go back. But they had to leave there. And what they did, it's really, and the all people attributed to me, it's wrong. The real hero in Romania was, for people being freed from prisons, was a woman, a lawyer, who has the courage to fight the Constitutional Court. And she won. And sometimes we can win. So, you know, I believe it's a good time when you see students in the street. I'm very sorry to see such a... I mean, the police in Amsterdam, they always arrested us, or in London, but what you see in United States, it's beyond my understanding. I mean, of course, we just got a punch or whatever. I mean, we fought with the police. It's, but not what I see in the United States.
Yeah, definitely.
And now I think it's interesting to see how all the people in Sweden from the campuses where they hold their protest, they just overflow in the streets protesting against Eurovision, which is a hilarious, hilarious event. I mean, what they did there, it's absolutely starting with the gay jokes by the co-host, which are absolutely pathetic, and ending up with so much money poured in promoting Israel everywhere on the internet. So they have to get the votes, so Israel will be in the final. It's terrible. I mean, it was 6,000 Swedish people protesting in front of Eurovision, and then it was pro-Israel 120. And when it's like that, I mean, you take it like a sign. I don't say there is the right is one side or another. I just say, you know, if it is a democracy, look a little bit how many people say something and do something. I mean, right?
Yeah, definitely. At least in my circles, the boycott of Eurovision is very widespread. So honestly, I haven't really heard much about it. I've like stayed away from it as much as possible, apart from vaguely following the continued lack of reaction to Israel's candidate, to the song lyrics, to I wouldn't even call it a controversy. I think that it's outright wrong that they let Israel
Yeah, but it's also, it's unbelievable, you know. It's another, I mean, I never followed Eurovision as a music contest. It's not my style. But it's funny because this contest exists because of the gay people.
Yeah.
Yeah, LGBT, trans, gay, whatever you want. But what is absolutely, this, I never followed the contest. But this year I followed step by step because of the politics. Was the best political stand-up comedy I ever saw in my life. I mean, the presenters of the, to ignore and to pretend everything it's a joke and doesn't exist, it's unbelievable.
It feels like the Hunger Games to me.
And by the way, maybe you don't know, before the final, the Belgium contestant was just disappeared from two rehearsal. And I was like, oh my God, he was kidnapped. He was taken. I mean, what do you believe when he disappeared? And then in the press conference, the organizer said he is under investigation for an incident. I mean, it's Eurovision, it's not CIA, it's not Mossad. Guys, what's happening? I mean, it's Eurovision. Now I follow Eurovision like I'm watching a spy movie. The Belgian disappeared and he's under investigation for what? For music? I mean, we are going crazy, really. I have been reading the press this week, and I have to admit, some of the interviews I've read on Diagonal, like a journalist, but I asked Miruna to go for a deeper read of three interesting interviews in the press this week with Pet Shop Boys in Financial Times. Very interesting interview. Omar Sy in Le Parisien, the famous French actor. And Salman Rushdie, which everybody knows, Nobel Prize winner and fantastic writer. His interview is about the last book he published called Knife, about the attempted murder last year. So I thought it worth a discussion.
Yeah, definitely. I think all the interviews you picked, in some ways, they work together and that they, and they almost answer to each other, because I feel like they all take moments that we're currently experiencing socially, culturally, and really approach them from the personal angle of the person being interviewed. Whilst that's a thing, I think there's also lots of range. If it's okay with you, I'd like to start with Omar Sy, whose interview in Le Parisien came out last week. So for context, he is the star of the Netflix series Lupin, and he's also going to be a member of the jury at Cannes this year. He's a very well-respected actor and recently author, so he's just come out with a book called Viens, on se parle, which translates to Come, let's talk to each other. And it's basically him recounting, it's a pseudo-memoir kind of thing, him recounting his life growing up in the banlieue, so a working-class neighborhood just outside of Paris, and his journey to becoming an actor. And he's been giving a lot of interviews, kind of talking about the state of France in terms of French national identity and French community. And he sees France as a very divided place now, which makes a lot of sense. The rise of the far right has not made it a very hospitable place for the many French immigrants that make up the French community, the French national community nowadays. And he's also mentioned, I don't know if you've kept up with this, Raz, but recently there was a big scandal because there was basically this French singer called Aya Nakamura. She was said to perform to represent France at the Olympic Games in the summer. And there was so much backlash in terms of that, people calling her not French and loads of things like that. And it's kind of sparked another debate of what does it mean to be French, which I think Omar Sy is really delving into.
Omar Sy was always a vocal advocate of black rights and human rights, generally speaking. And I agree with that. My main question still remains, why Omar Sy never pronounced queer, LGBT, gay, lesbian, transgender, or any of these words? I mean, I have a little bit of doubt here. Human rights for him means everything but LGBT, or I don't understand.
You can... It may not necessarily be that he's homophobic. It's that I guess you can only have so many battles to fight. And if he, I mean, obviously he has a very personal connection to black rights, and especially having grown up in a banlieue and all these things, I guess he is concentrating on this, on something that I guess he knows in a way better, that he relates to, and that he can maybe help more than in communities that he's not part of, if that makes sense.
I am not part of a women community who had abortion. And I always, when I say human rights, I talk about abortion rights for women. And it's not, I mean, I'm gay. It's theoretically, it's not, but I feel like racism, discrimination by any nature, women's rights, children's rights. Because that's another thing we don't discuss enough, children's rights. There are children in Malaysia, in Bangladesh, in China, working in factories. Okay, he chose a battle for, I completely understand. I mean, like Jean Genet was on the part of the Black Panthers in a way. But let's be clear, if you are on the side of human rights and you want to make this world better, then we have to make it better for everybody. What about when you talk about black rights? What about queer black people?
Yeah, but just because he's never said that he's an ally, an LGBT ally, doesn't mean he isn't. I mean, he is a public figure. You have to also think about that.
I didn't ask him to be an ally or anything. I asked him, as a fan of the series, I asked him to pronounce LGBT or queer after he says all the people who are discriminated, to insert in this phrase this. That's it. I don't pretend he will do a campaign or anything. And just to be clear, I really like him as an actor, and I like Arsène Lupin. Oh, let's make it clear for people who doesn't know. Arsène Lupin is a very, very famous character, like Sherlock Holmes, or maybe with the exception of, I mean, Sherlock Holmes was on the right side, Arsène Lupin was a thief, and but it's a very interesting series, and it's well done. It's on Netflix, I think, if I remember well. And but this is the only thing I'm asking for him. Just acknowledge black queer exists.
Well, this is also relevant to our discussion that we just had about rights. But so Salman Rushdie, in his, he did a number of interviews in the last few years. I guess you could all merge them into one. Again, for his upcoming book, which you said, Knife, Meditations After an Attempted Murder. And he talks about how writing at first after this trauma was a really impossible act, and it felt kind of futile, but that he's kind of found the power in it again. And he urges people, especially young people, he mentions in an interview, to not forget that the word has power. And I was very, very inspired by that. And I'm very excited to read his book. I don't know if you've read some of the interviews with him as well.
Yes, I did. And I've always been impressed by Salman Rushdie, not by his literature, of course. I'm coming from literature, as a fact. And but I was impressed by his life. I mean, the guy was under fatwa, right?
It's, yes.
Since 30 years ago. Fatwa is, for just to explain, it's the death conviction by a Muslim authority. In this case was Ayatollah Khomeini, if I remember well, the supreme leader of Iran, convicted him to death. So fatwa says any believer, if he sees that person, should kill the person. And after 30 years, when everybody thought this just went away, some guy, very young guy, who wasn't been born, I think, at the moment when fatwa was released, he attacked him and stabbed him so many times and also stabbed him in an eye. And I was listening to him at John Stewart in studio, and he made jokes and he talked about rights, and he encouraged the students who was were in campuses protesting. And it's fantastic to see this kind of power. I mean, he's 70 years old. And by the way, you know, he almost died. They suspected him of prostate cancer. So the man is really something.
Yeah, he's lived through a lot in the last year. I'd like to end the discussion with him with a quote that from him that really stuck with me. He says that his new book is an attempt to, quote, answer violence with art. But he continues that, and he writes, "Instead of being a man lying on a stage in a pool of blood, I'm a man writing a book about a man live on stage with a pool of blood." That felt cool.
Indeed. It's nice to end with this quote and go to the last interview we...
with Pet Shop Boys.
It was remarkable in the last weeks with Pet Shop Boys.
Raz, did you listen to Pet Shop Boys in your youth?
Yeah, of course I did. I mean, yeah, I think I was a teenager when I was listening to It's a Sin. And It's a Sin was released in 80-something. So imagine what a powerful thing was to hear singing about you in public by such a band. And Pet Shop Boys was extraordinarily popular at the time.
Yeah, and I mean, did you know, I didn't know until this interview, that Neil Tennant, who is one part of the duo of Pet Shop Boys, was a music journalist before he became a singer. And I think that's so cool.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And also, I think it's so cool to see them after so many years releasing a new LP. You can see this couple together after 40 years. And dancing on the stage. I mean, for me, it's mesmerizing.
Yeah, and the interviewer kept asking them, did you ever think about breaking up? Did you ever have a fight? Because, you know, so many bands, so many duos, they end up breaking up after a few years. But they just stayed together. They were like, no, we were fine with each other for like 40-odd years. I think it's so cool. And yeah, even now they're like 65 or something. They have fish and chips that go to the theater together. As a like tradition, I think it's very, very cute.
I love them. It's that such an example of professional, personal, and no scandals, no press, no. They was very, very, very famous, but still, you know, they had their life in a decent way. And I remember they said something about also, I think something about Taylor Swift and AI also in the interview, but I don't remember exactly what was about
Taylor Swift. They said, well, with both Taylor Swift and AI, they said, I don't understand. Essentially, they said they've used AI because they were asked if they'd used AI to make music recently. And they said, no, they've used it to like come up with a quote for advertising for their tour or something, or they've never used it for lyrics. But they weren't super skeptical about it. They were just like, we don't want to do that personally, but go ahead if you want to do it. That was the consensus. And about Taylor Swift, it was kind of like they had this blockage. They couldn't understand why people are so obsessed with her in the way that like in the way that she is the most, probably the most successful or well-known musician in the world now. And they just couldn't understand this like rabid fandom kind of mentality that Taylor Swift fans often adopt.
Taylor Swift it's not my kind of music. Even if it was, I don't understand what some teenagers, pre-teenagers, some of them, they say when they are upset, I've read somewhere in New York Times, when they are upset, they listen to the words of Taylor Swift to guide them in life. I'm very scared about that. At that moment, I went to my iPad and I start reading. I mean, I have a PhD in poetry. I try to understand what's to guide you in life when you are 13 years old from Taylor Swift. I'm very sorry to say that's not poetry, of course. It's but beyond that, how that is guiding your life? It's scary. You should be guided by Salman Rushdie, not by Taylor Swift. But it's amazing. The brand. I mean, the woman has objects. They have a magazine with her name. They have. So I think Pet Shop Boys, now I have the interview in front of me, and they said something like it's a generational thing because it slightly puzzles people. And you're never really aware of the music. You read that she's unbelievably famous. And then you go there because everybody goes there and it's so famous. So all these kind of things, it's interesting. But look, Pet Shop Boys never did that. And they, after 40 years, we still talk about them. Do you think we will talk about Taylor Swift in 40 years?
Only time will tell, I guess.
We are at the end of the episode, and as usual, we talk about what to see these days, being in cinema or online. Mirvina, as usually, you are our not only editor-in-chief, but you are also a film specialist. What do you recommend us this week?
So recently, I've gone on a little self-imposed retrospective of this Belgian filmmaker called Chantal Akerman. She is queer, she is a feminist, and she's really revolutionized cinema anyways. I mean, Sight and Sound called one of her films, Jeanne Dielman, they called it the best film ever 2 years ago. So I think she's definitely a big deal. Despite that, she's kind of stayed on the margins of art house cinema for most of her life. I'd really recommend Jeanne Dielman to start with, but also this beautiful, unsettling queer film called Je tue, il, elle. So me, you, he, she. As well as, I really love her documentaries. You can find News from Home on BFI Player. And it's that one is essentially just shots of New York superimposed with voiceover of Akerman reading letters from her mum, because Akerman lived in New York for a few years. So yeah, her films are about queerness. They're about strong women. They're about mother-daughter relationships. They're about Jewish identity being the generation after the Holocaust, so the generation of post-memory, as Akerman is or was. So there's a lot to find for anyone who enjoys her film. And a lot of her films are available on BFI Player.
What is BFI Player?
It is the streaming platform of the British Film Institute. So it just works as usual in the UK, I think.
And the ones who also organize the queer film festival,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, the BFI organized the Flare.
Chantal Akerman also is, have to say, coming also being part of the alt world. And she's also a fabulous artist, one of the best contemporary artists. So, yes, an extraordinary artsy recommendation. So, yeah, very good idea, Chantal Akerman. And I will come with something classical, a movie called Maurice. I don't know how many people read the book. It's a novel of E.M. Forster. E.M. Forster, a famous British writer and one of the classics, actually.
Have you been all right? Have you? No.
It's a very, very, very beautiful movie. You can find it basically on any platform. You can pay for it. I mean, Netflix, no, but all other platforms you can pay and see it. And it's a marvelous love story, an excellent movie, beautiful cast with a young Hugh Grant, a young James Wilby, so cute, and a young Rupert Graves. And all of them directed by the wonderful and fabulous James Ivory. So I recommend you to see this with your loved one. In a nice, perfumed, romantic night, an old movie. It will be beautiful, trust me. And until next time.
This was Gen Clash from London and Vienna with Maruna Tiberio and Rizvani On, a production of Gay 45, a smart indie queer magazine. As usual, Gen Clash is fed by the amazing news editor Taylor Abbott and produced by the creative audio engineer Emil Dragomirescu, with the fabulous original music created by GS Bumps. For an insight into where we select the topics discussed, subscribe to our The Nine newsletter. Link in the description of the episode. If you want to listen to the podcast as soon as it's published, click on the follow button. For our podcast listeners, we have a special gift, a gift of knowledge. For a limited time, the subscriptions on gay45.com are 80% less. Do not miss it. Go to gay45.com for more details and to read our wealth of articles. Send your suggestions to gay45.com/podcast. We are eager to hear your ideas and proposals. That's all for now. Spread the word about us. Until next time.